You can't disconnect security from the economy. The threat from the Chinese Communist Party is centrally an economic threat today. And so to the extent we got that piece right and put America on a sounder economic footing around the world, I hope that will help not only the businesses be successful, but will reduce risk so our military doesn't have to go do hard stuff in really difficult places.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
This month, Money Maze podcast host Simon Brewer has handed over the reins to me. I'm Jen Prosek, founder and managing partner Prosek Partners. After being featured on the show, I'm delighted to be the guest host of this series, recorded from our Madison Avenue office in New York. We are now joined by the 70th Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who served as Secretary of State under President Trump and also served as President Trump's CIA director. Before that, he was elected to four terms in Congress representing Kansas. He is an entrepreneur. He is a best-selling author. And we're going to learn a lot today about Mike Pompeo and his views. So welcome, Mike.
It's great to be with you, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on. It's great that I can be here in my shirt sleeves and we can get after and get to work.
Yes, we're thrilled to have you. You look relaxed, which is great. So you are the only person, if I am right, to have served as CIA director and secretary of state, which is quite an undertaking, especially in a pretty tumultuous 4 years. Tell us what led up to that, and what do you think about you made you able to get both of those positions and keep both of those positions?
It's a good question. My critics would say there's no explanation. It had to be a mistake. The truth is, if you look at the things that I've done in my life, in some ways they built to the moment which gave me the opportunity. It's like lots of things in life, I think. You stumble into opportunities, but lots of the work that was put in before put you in a place where it was possible. I think that's true here. As for the actual process, I had never met Donald Trump in my life. I had campaigned for Senator Marco Rubio with great energy and vigor, although radically unsuccessfully, and then had gotten reelected to my fourth term in Congress. November of 2016, the presidential election, the same day I was reelected. And I get a call just a few days later from Vice President-elect Pence, who asked me if I would consider joining the administration, just out of nowhere. And I reminded him that I'd worked very hard against President Trump in the primary. And he said, no problem. And 4 days later, I was the nominee to be the CIA director. Just crazy and wonderful and an incredible privilege to serve America in those two roles. You asked, how did you sort of make it? The same way I've tried to do everything. You always know there's so much that you don't know. You're always deeply aware of the fact that it is a big, complicated world. But what you can do is build a team and work hard. And so my very first mission, even before I was confirmed as CIA director, I began immediately to think, who do I know? How am I going to build this out? How do I bring a team around with the skill set that will help me be successful on behalf of President Trump and America? And so I was getting ready for my confirmation, but I spent most of that time doing organizational work. You know how this goes. You run a big company. How do you put together the right human beings that will have sufficient talent, sufficient energy, sufficient commitment to the mission? I had a very deep mission and would be focused on it. Call it loyalty, call it what you will, but understood what we were trying to do. And then trying to get to know my new boss and to make sure they understood what it was his expectations were for me as well. And I think that work that we did in those intervening days gave me the space to be successful. And you're right, there weren't many who survived 4 years in senior posts in the Trump administration, and I was blessed enough to do that.
Well, I think you were more than blessed. We're going to find out what it is about you that allowed that. But now that you've had a little time to reflect, what are you most proud of in those 4 years?
I spent a lot of time thinking about the things I wish we had done better, less time focused on the things I think we did pretty well. If you stared at the things that I think will change history, I think the signature thing we achieved was a set of understandings in the Middle East that mean it's less likely that your kids or my kids will ever have to go fight and die there. And Israel will be safer, Middle Eastern countries, and most importantly, America will be. And then there'll be a huge commercial component to this as well, which in the end really does drive international relations. And that brings me to the second thing that I'm really proud of. We understood, I think because so many of us had come from business, right? Steven Mnuchin, Donald Trump himself, Wilbur Ross at Commerce. So many of us have spent most of our adult lives in capital markets, taking risk and getting our heads kicked in, competing, many of us in global commercial enterprises. We knew that the power of the American economy. And so as we thought about foreign policy, we often put economics at front and center of it. And I'm really proud of the fact that I think we connected America in places around the world as an economic engine in ways that will deliver really good security for us as well. You can't disconnect security from the economy. The threat from the Chinese Communist Party is centrally an economic threat today. And so to the extent we got that piece right and put America on a sounder economic footing around the world, I hope that will help not only the businesses be successful, but will reduce risk so our military doesn't have to go do hard stuff in really difficult places.
So the difficult places, we're getting right into it, China, Russia, and keeping us safer and our economy strong. Talk to us. You spend so much time. You know China and Russia and their leadership better than anyone I know. Tell us what we're facing in those two areas, starting with China.
Jennifer, there are deeper experts on those subject than me, but there's no one who spent as much time with these cast of characters as I did for 4 years. I'm sure the current Secretary of State and CIA director are doing the same today. So Russia is the immediate challenge because they chose to go invade a sovereign nation. Bad for the world. It's really bad for the United States. I know many in my party think we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine. Hardly use that term. No, you should be keeping America safe. And an element of keeping America safe is making sure Vladimir Putin doesn't sit on the seat of power in Kyiv, or worse yet, in Helsinki or Stockholm. His mission set wasn't just retake what he would view as the near abroad. It was a deep play for political control in the Baltic states in addition to in Ukraine. So we should get that right. We should provide the Ukrainians the things they need to fight and win. They haven't asked for our boys and girls. They've just asked for stuff at this point. And we should provide them stuff because we can. And we're really good at making stuff that can help a nation like them do the things they need to do. But in the end, Russia has 1,000 nuclear warheads, a very capable, powerful leader. I've been criticized for saying that. Putin screwed up. He made a strategic blunder. There's no doubt about that. But don't underestimate. Don't think for a moment this is over or is going to be over or that the Russians are intent on capitulating. I don't think that for a moment. It takes continued resolve and strength. And there's only one way to deter these guys, and it is with power. That brings me to the nexus between Russia and China today. So it's always been there, always been complicated, I think probably forever shall be. But if you looked at the things that can change how our kids and grandkids will live, it's not Russia, it is China. And in fact, it is Chinese Communist Party. And even more precisely, it is Xi Jinping. And so we all need to just figure out, and this is complicated, how do you achieve what Reagan achieved with the Soviet Union? Right, which is to convince the people in those places and the leaders in those places to begin to behave in ways that are more fundamentally decent and certainly less prone to kinetic conflict. How do you do that with the deep economic ties that we have between not only the United States and China, but Germany, sitting in the United Kingdom, huge export partners, and frankly, import customers for the Chinese Communist Party? So we have to think our way through about how we do that. Maybe this brings me back to question one. Of the things I'm most proud of, it was redirecting American foreign policy to acknowledge the central threat to our way of life from the Chinese Communist Party under Xi's leadership. And it was just the first part of a 12-step program, right? The first step is always, I have a problem. We got to step one. We acknowledged the problem, which for 40 years we had ignored or turned the other cheek. And then we didn't get much further. Much work remains.
What can we expect, do you think, in the Russian-Ukraine conflict? And what did the situation with the attempt, what did that mean? Or did it not mean anything?
Jennifer, the truth is, I've heard all the so-called experts say they know what that means. I always was so cautious that as outsiders, we could ever understand what's really going on inside of Russian leadership. I always was very humble about the scope and the depth and the clarity of, do we really know what Prigozhin was up to? Do we really know the second in command is a guy named Petrushev, who I met, bad guy. Do we really know what his plotting and planning is? I don't know that we actually do. Maybe our intelligence services have a better read. We can say this for sure. We can say this was an embarrassment for Putin, no matter how it went. That will mean that he will have to take even stricter actions inside of his own country to prevent something like this from happening again. A second affront to his power in this way would diminish him even more than this one did. But we should also acknowledge he's almost certainly still largely in control, but that control could snap. In economics, they talk about this as stochastic or disruptive or black swan. Most time leaders bail, like Putin, isn't because, oh, we could see the trajectory and it was a pretty clear glide path. You wake up one morning and the world broke. And that's the most likely way this will happen as well. Our interests haven't changed, no matter what Prigozhin did or intended to do. Our interests remain in protecting the things that matter to America, but providing Europe and Ukraine the things they need to push back against this assault on basic property rights, basic understandings of trade. And we should never forget, we signed a piece of paper in 1994 that promised if this happened, we'd help them. It's called the Budapest Memorandum. Seldom seen or talked about. I wish the Biden administration would talk about this. But what we promised them, and our British friends, our German friends, our Japanese friends, our Taiwanese friends, our South Korean friends, our Philippine friends, all are watching. Like, really? Do you mean it, America, when you say you're going to do something when the moment occurs and it's hard? Will you actually do that? And so we should, if we're serious about deterrence, which is the model for China, the model for China has to be the Reagan model of deterrence. And frankly, the Trump model, what we were pretty successful at, is a model that doesn't permit the perception of weakness to creep into the bad guys' minds. And if you can do that, if you can keep that perception at bay, you should. And continuing to help the Ukrainians is a fundamental piece of that, especially in the aftermath of Afghanistan, where the whole world could see, oh my goodness, this isn't the America I used to be friends with and rely upon. Or frankly, if you're an adversary, this isn't the America I used to fear.
I love that reminder of keeping our promises as Americans. I think that's incredibly important.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by Livetrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. Livetrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, Bordeaux Index/Livetrade.
Just one more minute on the deterrence model. You spend time in your book, Never Give an Inch, your bestseller, on the deterrence model. And you don't go so far to say that you deterred Vladimir Putin in the Trump administration, but you have some pride about keeping him at bay during that time. What do you think you did that was effective?
It's such a great question, Jennifer, because it all seems like so long ago. But remember, for the first 2.5 years, we were all viewed as Russian assets by the American mainstream media. My president gets impeached because of a phone call with Mr. Zelensky, who's now running a great operation in Ukraine. These things all come back. These are deeply connected. Yeah, I'm not so sure I take pride in it, but I do explain. I think the Russians knew that we were either crazy or really good or serious about enforcing the things we said we'd do. I'm agnostic as to which it is. I think I know, but others would deny it. Here's what I can prove. He didn't take any of Ukraine on our watch. This actually begins in 2014 with Vladimir Putin taking Crimea, so about 25% of the real estate. For 4 years, he doesn't take any more. We didn't get Crimea back, that's true. But then we're gone for a few months and he becomes adventuresome, aggressive again, killing more Ukrainians again. Progressive left would tell you we were just lucky. I would argue that the conversations I had with Bortnikov and Naryshkin, the leaders of their intelligence services, the conversations that were had with Lavrov and that the National Security Advisor had with Petrushev, we didn't claim we were going to do all things always, but we said, here's a few things you can't do, and if you do them, this will end badly. And when they did them, it ended badly. I think Putin came to respect that. And I think most importantly, his desire, which has been unabated and probably will always remain so, his desire to create greater Russia, it wasn't the moment, right? It wasn't the time. And so if you said, what do? We just reminded him that these things can be costly, and so don't do it. And he didn't, and you can say whatever you want, but it didn't take long before that model was abandoned by a president who said a minor incursion might be okay. Could have been a slip up, could have been a gaffe. But the president of the United States said those words, and man, bad things followed, especially bad things for the Ukrainian people.
So apply that deterrence model to the Chinese situation. What would you recommend at this point?
Oh my goodness. So this is a very long answer because it's multifaceted. So I'll start with the place that we all need to focus on, and that is economic. The central thesis of the Chinese Communist Party has been hide your strength and bide your time for 25 years. Xi now thinks, I did that. I grew my economy. I'm now the largest economy in the world, or maybe the second largest economy in the world. I still don't have the technological breadth and depth of the West, but I'm pretty good. And I probably still need to steal stuff, but not quite as much. And so you can see his increasing aggressiveness economically. Well, how does that manifest itself? It manifests itself by sucking in some American businesses and making friends of them, places he still needs technology, know-how, management expertise, places where he realizes he can gain leverage on American policy. Second, he begins to make friends around the world. The Belt and Road Initiative would be one piece of that, right? Where he builds out infrastructure in exchange for political favors, or just more crudely, puts money in brown paper bags and buys leaders in countries around the world. We don't play that game. We shouldn't play that game, but he does, and it works in certain places. So building out political influence around the world and then continuing to expand his own military capabilities. And so you got to confront him in each of those. Economically, this looks pretty straightforward with a central thesis of reciprocity. You want to buy land. You, the Chinese Communist Party, want to buy land in the United States. Sounds good. We're an open economy. Knock yourself out. We want to buy land near your military bases in China. Oh, we can't. All right. Well, you can't buy them here either then, right? We should begin to enforce in the Chinese mind that it's not a one-way racket. They can't have all the things that benefit them without opening up their economy as well. And if we did that, if we adopt this reciprocity, think about how we file on our various stock exchanges, think about a regulatory set of rules. If you want in the Biden administration, how about this for reciprocity? If we're going to shut down our coal-fired power plants, so are you. And if you don't, which of course they never will, then we're going to impose real costs on you. It's not the place I'd pick. I wouldn't pick climate change as the place to plant my flag, but the Biden administration has. And so at the very least, if you're going to burden the American economy and destroy large sectors here, you should make sure that the other guys aren't putting more carbon into the air, undermining the very policy goal that you state that you have. So economically, it's about reciprocity. Second, it's about friend building. I just got back yesterday from Tokyo, and the Biden administration, I'll give them credit. They had Prime Minister Modi in town. They had the president of South Korea to come visit for a state dinner. Those are powerful allies and friends in the region, and they need to be part of the American economic complex and the American understanding of how nations engage. India, Australia, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Malaysia. These are big economies. And when we get those economies all working together, I think the leadership in China will have to confront an enormous challenge. And I hope that will cause them to conform and behave. This is probably worth last note. When we do those things, my hope isn't that this will cause Xi Jinping to go to war. It's in fact just the opposite. And maybe Xi Jinping can't do this, but others can. I think they'll come to see it's not in the Chinese government and the Chinese people and the Communist Party's best interest to be so confrontational. My goal isn't to destroy the Chinese economy and take down the economic growth that you've had hundreds of millions of people experience over the last 25 years. Just the opposite. I want good things for the Chinese people as well. But you can't do that on the back of Americans. So we all have to be prepared to help countries in the region as a pure security matter, but most importantly, as an economic matter.
So you wrote a bestseller called Never Give an Inch. So this is a good opportunity to talk about that. I think sometimes people misunderstand the title of your book to mean that you don't compromise, but I've come to learn that that's not actually the case. Tell us a little bit about how we should think about your Never Give an Inch philosophy. Then I'm going to ask you a couple of my favorite highlights from the book.
Oh my gosh. So the title was just fun.
Didn't your son come up with it or something?
It was fun because it's something I told my son as he was growing up, and he reminded me, and he said, that's what you should lead with. But within the first 20 pages, you can find me working out arrangements, compromises. This is how we do business. I spent most of my life in the private sector, very seldom got everything I wanted. Always had to find a way to create value, make situations where everybody was, at least at the margin, better off and perceived it as so. There are places where you do have to draw lines. And that's what Never Give an Inch attempts to delineate. I talk about risk an awful lot in the book. Jennifer, you know this, right? You're running a big company and you're helping lots of clients think about how to manage risk. And so this was the mission set. And to manage risk appropriately, there are just things you have to tell folks, hey, this is just a line. We're not going past this. You can rail on it. You can go out of the press and tell them I said, right. But when it comes to basic fundamental understandings of human rights, yeah, these things matter to us. When it comes to sovereignty, you know, we're going to get it right. We're going to get our border right. We hope you'll get your border right. Because these nation states, the central thesis of the post-World War II order of the nation state as the central actor on the global stage, turns out made people a lot of money. And when I say that, GDP per capita has never been higher in the history of civilization. We live at the most glorious time in human history. It's easy to get mired in the negative. Like, we're all pretty damn lucky. Certainly here in America, we're really blessed. And so we should never forget that. That means there's just things you have to say, no, I'm not going there. We're not going to touch that. But on how many parts per million of sulfur, or are we going to spend $82 million or $92 million on a project in Papua New Guinea? You can argue about those till the cats come home, and happy to compromise, happy to give a whole handful of inches if it accomplishes an American objective.
I will say, I think your book is really riveting and very honest. And you talked about keeping promises and you're a man of faith. I thought one of the most interesting stories you tell in the book is about that speech you made in Cairo and the decisions you had to make around that, which I thought were pretty brave and against counsel, by the way. Could you tell the listeners just a little bit about that one anecdote? There's so many, but it's one of my favorites.
It's a good story. And you'll appreciate this too, Jennifer. The best compliment of my book came from a couple of my really close friends of some 40 years who read it and said, dude, that sounds like you. As good as it gets. The story was, I'm an evangelical Christian, but I was America's Secretary of State, not the Presbyterian Church's Secretary of State or the Southern Baptist Convention Secretary of State. I was America's Secretary of State. But nonetheless, it was important always to be open with people about how I thought about problems, how I approached the world, how I thought about them as human beings endowed by their creator. So I was headed to Cairo to give a speech that I'd wanted to give all my life, but never thought I'd get a chance. Or I say all my life. I'd wanted to give this speech for 10 years. It was in response to something President Obama had said. President Obama had gone to Cairo and given this speech, which essentially described America's place in the Middle East as being the problem. And I was convinced and remain convinced that while we may have caused problems in the Middle East, probably undoubtedly true, we're a force for good. We were trying to get it right for them. We weren't trying to take over a country. We were just trying to make things better for them. It was always from a noble place. And President Obama just had rejected that. So I wanted to go to Cairo to give the counter speech, the counter narrative about American greatness and how we were there to try and figure out good solutions that fit with their country's governance models and their challenges. I thought, well, I'll start this speech by just saying, I'm Mike Pompeo, an evangelical Christian. And as I usually did, I drafted an outline in the first paragraph and the last paragraph. So that's what I wrote and sent it down to the speech team. And it came back with that line erased, gone. Good thing they blacklined it, so I didn't forget. I could see that I had written it. Eventually, we went back and forth, and I left it in, Jennifer, in the end. And it turns out I still get comments. It's like your question this morning. I get more comments about that than just about anything else I ever said. A lot of times from faithful Islamic leaders who will say, you know, we loved that because I get it. We're both Abrahamic faiths, but very different in many theological perspectives. But you were just honest about who you were. and you were straight up and you were committed and disciplined. And we love commitment, discipline, and honesty. And so I get that all the time. And I think all of us should remember that in every place that we go. You get in hard deals and you get in hard places. It's easy just to gild the lily around the edge, often just to go, you know, here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I believe. And here's why I believe it. And have a real discussion instead of trying to hide things and work around things that really sit at the substrate of who we are. And if you do that and do that well, there's days it probably causes more problems than it should. But I think in the end, we're all better off when we do that. And it was lovely and wonderful. And I still welcome these letters and comments I get from people on it. And I stack them in the boxes in my office here.
Well, we both know sometimes when you take a calculated risk against counsel and it works out, you get the greatest achievement of all. But authenticity matters. I asked you in the beginning, how the heck did you become the CIA director and the Secretary of State? But I kind of know the answer. Hard work. I mean, you were number one in your class at West Point. You were at Harvard Law School. You've started two businesses. You were a congressman. There's really nothing you haven't done. But people may not necessarily understand your business and entrepreneurial career, which I find very fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit about the businesses? You've said you come from business, but I'm not sure everyone knows that. Tell us a little bit about the businesses you started and the experience there.
Sure. So I was practicing law in Washington, D.C., having a fine time around really smart people, but knew I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. And then this amazing opportunity to start a company with three of my best friends from West Point. Turned out, as it worked out, it was in Wichita, Kansas, a place that I had known well because my mother grew up not far from there, but pure coincidence that we ended back in that place. And it was a machine shop, basically. We had lathes and mills and programmers, and we made airplane parts for Gulfstream and Lockheed and Cessna and Learjet and the like. Airframe components, mostly metal stuff, welding, riveting, simple things. And it was awesome. There's nothing like the smell of burnt grease on a manufacturing floor to make me happy. Hardworking people as part of my team. It's great. So we built that. We did a handful of acquisitions. We got slammed at 9/11 when we really had some, and I talk about this in the book, we really had some bad days, difficult days, but ran that for 6-7 years and then got hired to run a second company, kind of in the same space, hard metal goods, oil and gas industry. So the customers were the midstream and downstream guys in Midland and Odessa and Calgary, Canada. A wonderful, fun business. We had a big drilling rig repair, equipment repair shop in Midland, Odessa. It was great. And that's what I did. And then the good news is I'm now back doing the same thing, not quite as directly in terms of manufacturing, but now back in the commercial space, trying to build out an investment advisory business.
Tell us what you're doing.
We're working along with a couple of friends and partners to build out a firm that's an investment advisory firm. We've raised some capital, so we have a fund as well, but we're focused on doing industrial hard tech projects, and almost all of the things that we have worked on to date have turned out to have a geopolitical component to them. So pretty natural that these are mostly American companies that we're working with, but we're trying to help them someplace in the world cut through some challenge and make good decisions about either how to help a global 1,000 company make an investment here in America or an American company figure out how to partner with someone not inside the United States as well. It is a ton of fun, and we think it's going to be very successful. We're enjoying the heck out of it.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. In addition, I'd like to quickly share a few details about Gain, who we're highlighting and supporting as our 2023 third quarter partner. Gain, which stands for Girls Are Investors, is a leading charity dedicated to improving gender diversity in the investment management industry. Gain currently has a team of over 1,000 volunteers dedicated to helping young women understand the industry and their potential careers in it. They're always open to welcoming new volunteers or sponsors who are looking to support their mission. If this is something yourself or any of your colleagues might be interested in, please visit gainuk.org to learn more, or just tap the link in the episode description right here in your preferred podcast app.
Now, you have to talk to the audience about your first job at Baskin-Robbins scooping ice cream, because it's a fun one, but it shows that how much you learn from your first work experience. So tell us a little bit about that one. And then I'm going to have to ask you about the upcoming election and your points of view.
Happy to take both of them. The Baskin-Robbins one's much easier question. At 15, I think I was old enough to work. My sister was already there, and so she drug the family over to Baskin-Robbins. It's now in our blood. To your point, Jennifer, when a lot of folks listening to this have children or grandkids, every chance they get to work, whether it's on the family farm or in a small company, whatever it is, it creates structure, and you learn how to be part of a team. And by the way, you learn you're not always in charge, which is maybe one of the most important lessons for leaders to appreciate, to understand what it means to be part of an organization and to have things that you think, gosh, I can really do a lot better than mopping the floor at Baskin-Robbins at midnight on a Saturday night. But the truth is, taught me a lot. The guy who owned this place was a fellow named Barry Takamoto, who was in Costa Mesa, California. And I can't remember exactly where. I think it was on MacArthur Boulevard. Anyway, you can find it. I think it's still there. I'd work everybody. They'd say, hey, Mike, you know, you work from 2 to 8. I want to go to a movie. Will you take my 8 to midnight shift? And I almost always said yes, because A, I love the money. $2.75 an hour was big time. I loved it. And it just felt good to put it in the bank. But it also taught me a lot. And Barry would always remind me, he would come in from time to time and just say, did you make Baskin-Robbins better today? That was his go-to line. What'd you do to make this place better today? I hope we can all, no matter where we sit in life, whether it's with our family or coaching our kids' soccer team or whatever it is, did you make it a little bit better today? Maybe not. Maybe today you made it a little bit worse. But tomorrow, can you help it? Can you make it better? And I think that's what Barry Takamoto taught me most from that first job.
I love that story. So let's talk about the future of America. You are long on America. You said we're very happy to be Americans. I agree, we're very lucky. Looking at an election coming up, what do you think the most important issues to focus on? What do you hope the next administration will really focus on?
Thanks for the chance to talk about this, given that I made the decision not to run, further proving my sanity, perhaps. I'm hopeful that it'll be about the big things, the things that really matter to every American. I'm a conservative Republican. I make no bones about that. I think our theory of the place and role of government is the right one. But I hope we'll have conversations about that and what that looks like in modern times, times in which we exist. And so I hope we'll have good discussions about what should we be teaching our kids in the schools? What's going to propel them to successful lives as they decide what success looks like for them? What are the things we could do to keep basic law and order in place? We forget, when you're the Secretary of State, you see this all the time. You see how few countries are as capable of protecting basic security for people and property rights, which are the two fundamental pillars. If you go back, we just had the 4th of July, right? If you go back to the founding, when they talk about this, they talk about property. That's the central thing that lets someone like me get a step forward in the world, right? It's like, no, I made $2.75 an hour. I put it in the bank. And you know what? It's still there. If I leave it there, no government's going to come take that away from me or diminish it, or worse yet, allow inflation to make it worthless. We should talk about these things that really matter for social mobility in America, the chance for the next generation to live a life that's better than ours. I hope we'll stay away from the things that are like name-calling and clever tweets. By the way, I'm sometimes guilty of it too. The folks that are watching or listening to this, sign me up, go find YouTube. You'll find my bad days. They're out there. They're recorded for all of time. But I hope most days better angels grab us and get it right. And I hope in this political season that will happen as well. And I hope the media will take on their role in this. They have a responsibility to say, no. I asked you substantively about X. Tell us what you want to do to solve this problem. Not, oh, Smitty did it worse, or Sally did it different, or Joe's overweight, whatever. These things matter. And I hope that the American people will reward candidates that do that. I would take a candidate that I disagree with a little bit, but who was straight up, like, no, here's what I think, as opposed to someone who spent all their time looking backward and blaming somebody else for something. It's just not the American way. It's not in the best American tradition. I hope we can get there. I'm not optimistic that we will, given the current media environment. I'm going to push for it. I'm going to stay. I'm going to try and keep my voice in it. I'm going to try and call out people who aren't doing that and reward those who are and say, oh, that was great. That was a very substantive response. I couldn't disagree more, or I actually agree with part of it. But serious leaders have a responsibility to tell the American people why they want to be a school board member, or why they want to be a district attorney, or why they want to be congressman or senator or president of the United States. And I hope we can get to that model.
So it sounds like you're still going to be a very big part of the conversation.
I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to try and steer it towards substance and reason and away from noise and chaos.
That sounds good to me. So we have only a couple minutes left, but I want to ask you, if you had to do either job again, what's the cooler job, CIA director or Secretary of State?
Oh, that's a layup. Being the CIA director is the coolest job that I could ever possibly imagine for just a whole host of reasons. Lovely, lovely American patriots doing really hard work in a clandestine space in an incredibly difficult environment. Not quite like the movies would portray it every day, but boy, we ask these young women, these young men to do some really hard things. They're not political. Yes, sir. Roger. Got it. Got President Trump. Got President Obama. Got President Biden. We're on our mission. We know what we're doing. And that part was great. State Department, I loved trying to help solve very complex, big problems, but I prefer the background, not the foreground. And so for that reason, the CIA was just, you asked which job was cooler. That's probably it.
And if someone was just going to read just one or two chapters from your book, what do you think the highlights are?
Two places to go. One, read the opening statement that comes from a fellow American who was held hostage in North Korea. It's a remarkable. It's a very short piece. It's a page and a half as translated. His English isn't fantastic. But he tells this story of an America that came to get him when he was held in these unbelievable conditions. And he says, essentially, I don't think any other country would have taken as much risk to come save me and get me out of this terrible place. America is a wonderful, wonderful country. The chapter on the strike against Qasem Soleimani matters because it encapsulates risk-taking and deterrence in a way that I think is the highlight of the book in terms of modeling how we were about to lose deterrence against Iran, and we figured out a theory without putting 20,000 of our soldiers at risk, without creating World War III, how we could put them back to understanding America's place and not creating risk for us. And then the last chapter tries to take all of this and encapsulate how it is America ought to move forward. My theory of the case for another 250 years of American excellence. So those would be the three places. If you're going to dip in, I'd suggest those.
That is wonderful. Is there anything else you want to tell this huge audience of professionals and investment professionals?
Yeah, one last thought, Jennifer. And I mean this. I think I have a sense of who your audience is. I'm counting on you. I am counting on risk takers, entrepreneurs, business leaders to go out and crush it. And the government should do its part. We should stay out of your way. We should let you go do all the things you want to do, but know that American security depends on a powerful, creative, innovative, some days crushing American economy. And it's the people, Jennifer, that you and I both know that are out there every day doing this with their own money, on behalf of others, with others' money, but they're out there trying to figure out how you can go innovate, create, compete in incredibly difficult, complex economic and commercial spaces. And when they do, when we get this right, when America gets this right, we will be safer, our kids will be safer, and a poor person in Africa or in South Asia or in the Middle East, they will be better off because of what you do every day out there taking risk. It's a straight line from my perspective. And so the solutions to America's problems aren't likely to come from Washington, D.C. They are infinitely more likely to come from hundreds of thousands of people out there every day driving to take care of their families, their businesses, their communities in ways that only Americans have really figured out. And when we do that, and I'm convinced we will, we're going to get that next 250 years.
Well, I'm inspired, and I'm sure that just inspired a lot of people to keep at it. Thank you so much, Secretary Mike Pompeo. You are an inspiration. Keep the faith, and we'll be looking forward to seeing what you do in the next few years.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. You have a good day, too.
Many thanks for listening to this episode of the show. If you enjoyed the conversation, please do share the interview on your social media or write a quick review of the show on your preferred podcast app. You can find out more about the podcast and sign up for the excellent newsletter via moneymazepodcast.com. Plus, find out more about my business, ProSec, at ProSec.com. I founded this integrated financial communications and marketing business right out of college, and we employ about 400 people in 8 offices worldwide. Come check us out, and thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.